Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, your comments, your contributions, positive and negative. We welcome them all. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about scorpion venom. We'll get into that in a bit, but first it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, lecturer in the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Galway, and Dr. Laura Hayes, research fellow at the School of Cosmic Physics at Dias. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with the moon, Laura.
It does indeed. And, you know, this is actually quite an interesting story. It's a story about, is the moon shrinking? And the answer is yes. And it's also about looking at the moon from its tectonic activity, right? We think of the moon as being rock up there, not doing too much. It's old, boring, but it actually has tectonic activity. And we've known that for a long time. But we thought maybe the tectonic activity maybe finished billions of years ago, right? We're talking on geological scales, really, really long time. But this new study looked at maps of the moon using NASA's lunar mission called LRO, basically like a Google Maps of the moon.
Yeah.
Tried to like map out what was going on the moon, and could they see signatures of kind of tectonic activity? So little ridges and things like this. And what they found is they looked at this in really, really high resolution. So this mission is going around. It's taking these amazing images. It gets down to like a pixel scale or a kilometer every pixel, which is really, really amazing. And they found these really, really small wrinkles on the moon. And what they called them was basically small mare ridges, SMRs. These are kind of signatures of the moon having tectonic motions and shrinking. If you think of like an apple dying and it shrinks, or you kind of see the skin. So the wrinkles is kind of almost like an age thing as well. And what they were able to do is they were able to map these all out. They saw way more of them in different regions than they'd seen before. And then they mapped that with crater observations, right? So the moon's always been hit by things, and they could actually estimate the ages of these ridges. And what they found is that the ages of the production of these ridges from tectonic activity in the moon was more like 30 to 150 million years old, right? Which also sounds like a very long time ago, but much sooner and much younger than we really thought. And why this is interesting is telling us that there is still kind of tectonic activity happening on the moon. And we've known even from the Apollo missions that there are moonquakes. So this study is really showing about where these moonquakes could be and really thinking about the moon is maybe more alive than we had previously thought.
I've not heard of moonquakes before. When you say from the Apollo missions, did the astronauts actually feel moonquakes?
Yeah, so I mean, it wasn't that they were on the moon and like, oh my God, the moon is quaking. I think they had seismic monitors that they put down and were able to map it. And why this is important now is that we're going back to the moon, right? So Artemis, NASA program, there are people sending people to the moon next month. They're not going to land on the moon. They're going to do an orbit. But there's kind of huge kind of re-energization about going to the moon, right? Driven by whatever you want to call it, but interest anyway. And if you're going to put something on the moon, you want to land in a place that maybe doesn't have a big moonquake or kind of a large ridge. So this is why mapping of the moon is really prevalent at the moment. So this kind of study also kind of hints at, well, where are these moonquakes going to happen? And can we land somewhere where they're not going to happen? And they're different to Earth because, you know, on Earth, if we have an earthquake, the quakes can kind of dissipate with sea and land and things like this. The moon is a big rock and you basically have a moonquake can last for like an hour, right? So it kind of shakes for a very long time afterwards. So,
But does it matter if it's only a tiny moonshake? Like why do we not want to be near them? Why do we not want to be near where there might be a moonquake?
It depends if you're trying to land something that's really sensitive and you don't want it to be moving at that time or scientifically.
Right. And so I'm just trying to figure out how they aged these wrinkles. Like, because obviously there wasn't a before and after photograph that they could compare, right? Because we're talking 150 million years ago.
Yeah.
How do you age the crater hits? Like, how do you figure that out?
Yeah, I was actually very interested in this as well, because I was like, wait, how are they actually doing this, right? And it's they do it by looking at craters, right? So they look at a region and they see how many craters and the distribution of number and sizes of craters in a certain area. And they kind of say, well, okay, if you have a young crater, one that's just hit, and then you have kind of a ridge movement or an earthquake, it will actually shake the crater away. If it's dust and sand. So what they see is that regions around these ridges, there are less kind of new craters. And they're saying that this is because there was a crater hit and then it shifted the sand basically and then it disappeared. So by like studying a vast range of thousands of these craters, they could kind of make an estimate of age of how when this new ridge pops up.
Mm. The idea of going to the moon as an astronaut and going around the moon and coming back, like, I always think of Michael Collins, that poor astronaut who you know, was delighted to be part of the, you know, the Apollo 11 mission, but that, you know, Buzz and Neil got to go down and land on the moon and just experience being the first people to do that. And poor Michael Collins just sort of rotated around them and never got to put his foot in the moon. So, like, I think for those astronauts who are going to go there and just go around and come back, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like it'd be quite frustrating to me. All right. Our second story, Jessamine, has to do with spinal cord injuries. And this is something that obviously has been looked at for so many years, but it's a very slow science from the outside in terms of how everything else seems to be racing along. Fixing spinal cord injuries seems to be a very difficult problem.
Yeah, I mean, spinal cord injuries can be so debilitating and they affect so many people, but this is very exciting new research to address rehabilitation coming out of our own RCSI in Dublin. Basically, in new research published, they've managed to develop an implant that both kind of mechanically supports the spinal cord as it's trying to heal, but also helps the neurons themselves or the nerves within the spinal cord regenerate faster. So it's a very clever piece of engineering because it both has this kind of scaffold that bridges the gap, like the break that can happen in the spinal cord, and that matches the mechanical, the structure, the stiffness of it. It's kind of porous, so it's got little channels through it that the nerves can regrow in. But then it's also embedded with these little tiny particles that are effectively little blobs of RNA that switch on neural growth. And the way that they do that is really clever. They silence this gene called PTEN, which suppresses neuron regrowth. So basically, the combination of this mechanical support for the spinal cord itself, bridging the gap across like a spinal cord injury, and then also this RNA activation that makes the neurons grow more, has been shown now just in sort of in vitro, as they say, or like in a petri dish with neural cultures, but to be a really promising route for healing spinal cord injuries. It's also really important, as it turns out, that the RNA is just in like little tiny particles locally. This was an issue and part of why this approach wasn't tried before as like a larger scale drug, because the PTEN that I was talking about is also a tumor suppressor. So it's important that in the rest of the body, it stays turned off. Mm. But in the spinal cord region itself, this kind of localized activation of it is really important. And this is, I mean, really promising for anyone suffering from spinal cord injuries. Obviously, there's still a lot of ways to go before we could see an implant like this used in humans. The next work would have to be done in animals, but it's a really clever bit of engineering and some really promising results.
Yeah, there's lots of different approaches to trying to fix the spinal cord injury. It's very rare that a spinal cord is completely like severed, but you know, even a really bad bang can have, you know, really catastrophic effects to people's mobility. And of course, once you lose use of your limbs, you need to keep them sort of active and healthy and exercise those muscles constantly. It's exhausting. And as we heard from our piece with Mark Pollock many, many years ago, there's all these secondary things that come with being paralyzed that nobody talks about, you know, bladder function, erectile dysfunction, all these things that make living with paralysis so completely multifaceted. And so as a cure for the paralysis, it's a cure for lots of these other sort of downstream symptoms. So something really, really important. Is there any talk about how this compares to other treatments, or what the next stage is for this research? I mean, realistically, are they hoping that it could help these cord fibers reattach in a way that was functional and electrical?
Well, yeah, so the next work definitely has to be in animals, like in an actual living organism, because, I mean, there's a big difference between something in a petri dish and something in a full organism. And in some ways, it could be even better, right? Because there's a lot of like cell death signals and just sort of random biological shrapnel that you end up with in vitro. So it could potentially be more effective in a real living organism, or there could be unforeseen issues. So that's definitely the next steps for this. And I'll be looking forward to see what they find.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Jessamine. Our third story, Laura, has to do with psychedelic drugs. And we've been talking about how psychedelics could treat things like PTSD and depression for many years now. What's this study about?
Yeah, so that kind of builds on that study, right? There is this growing evidence that psychedelic drugs can have a huge positive impact on mental health disorders. And this key idea of this study, it's kind of an early phase study, looked at one controlled psychedelic experience, can it treat depression? And it's really promising results that's come out in Nature Medicine in this study. And they looked at treating, you know, it was a small sample of patients, 34 patients, but they looked at a psychedelic drug called DMT. So this is dimethyltryptamine. This is the same drug that's in ayahuasca, this Amazonian brew that you might have heard.
I was going to ask you, is it a frog licking?
Yeah.
Trip? Is it a comes from a cactus or something?
Yeah, so it can be formed naturally in many, many things. But right. What they used in the study was the chemical pureness of this, right? And what they did was they administered DMT to patients. So it was a blind study. So half the patients had DMT and half of them did not.
But what did the other patients get?
I guess...
Like a bump or something? Yeah, or how do they compare like with like?
Yeah, absolutely right. So I guess you have to remember this is not just let's go into the woods and take DMT and see if you feel better after. This was a controlled test in a setting of with psychotherapists and psychoanalysts, and it was actually administered intravenously, right? So they had these patients, they had a prepping with them, they gave 10 minutes intravenous drip of it. The good thing about DMT for this type of study is that it's very short living, right? So you have a psychedelic experience for maybe 20 minutes, right? So it's not hours and hours you're in a trip.
Yeah.
They were given a blindfold, music was playing, they kind of had their experience, and when they came out, they had a prolonged, you know, professional psychotherapy with a professional, right, after to kind of talk through this.
Because it's twinned with psychotherapy, which is a huge... The intervention is a dual action intervention.
Absolutely. It's the coupling of both the psychedelic experience with the psychotherapist. And why that's really amazing, what this study has shown is that, you know, it really has significant impacts for those patients that actually had the psychedelic experience. These are patients that have, you know, major depression that has lasted for over 10 years. And they found that a significant improvement from a week up to several months. Now, there are some kind of caveats there, right? If you are a patient that didn't, or you're a placebo, you would know you didn't have a psychedelic experience.
Yeah.
But overall, really, really exciting results. Mm. I think this is really proving that those studies are going further, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in the future.
For sure. Jessamine, finally, we're going to be talking about running and ultra-endurance running.
That's right. This is about anything that is a run longer than a marathon, so longer than those 42 kilometers. This is new research out of the University of Colorado Anschutz, and basically looking at the health of red blood cells, both before and after a 40-kilometer trail race and a 171-kilometer trail race, the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc. Yeah, these are big deal races, both up in the mountains in France. Lots of elevation change as well. The 171-kilometer race has about 10 kilometers of elevation change. So after both races, there's a lot of damage to red blood cells, is what the researchers found. There's mechanical damage, probably from the variation in fluid pressure in your blood as you're just running around and hitting the ground, but also inflammation, oxidative stress, and perhaps unsurprisingly, as the length of the run increases, more red blood cells are lost and more of the remaining ones are damaged.
But that's a temporary thing, right? Because you used to do these sort of runs, right? This is sort of a temporary thing?
Well, so I think that's the question here, right? It obviously is temporary. I think the longest run that I ever did in a day would have been 64 kilometers, the Causeway Coast Ultra up north, which is great. It's such a beautiful run. And yeah, at the end, you're not feeling your best exactly. So in a way, I'm not too surprised by this. But I think the real question, right, is like, you know, immediately after the race, yes, red blood cells are damaged. And then like, how long does that last? What is the recovery like? And then what is the longer term impact of it? So they really only had these two data points before and immediately after the race.
How is that even medically useful?
Well, it's a starting point. But, you know, you could make an argument either way, like clearing out these older red blood cells regularly could potentially lead to you having mostly younger and very efficient red blood cells, but only if you have enough recovery time in between. So really the long-term impact and whether it is good or bad is not clear. I mean, exercise in general is small amounts of damage that you then heal from and you heal stronger. Like that's how it works in muscles, at least. So I think the real question is here in terms of these red blood cells, is this doing long-term damage? Or is it part of what makes people who do these sorts of races regularly better and better at them? And you really need a longitudinal study to be able to say that.
Dr. Jessamine Fairfield and Dr. Laura Hayes, thanks very much. Now, most of us would think about scorpions in the realm of, you know, documentaries in the desert, maybe a horror film, but they are a reality for lots of people living in hot climates where they cause up to 3,000 deaths per year. What if we could predict with scientific precision where the world's deadliest scorpions are most likely to strike? Well, this is a question that Dr. Michel Dugon, assistant professor in zoology at the University of Galway and PI of the Venom Systems Lab, is trying to answer. Michel, it's lovely to have you on the program. It's a very unusual partnership to hear about, University of Galway and University of Morocco. How did you get involved in this project?
Oh, well, this is actually part of a long-standing collaboration between the University Imzor in Agadir in the south of Morocco and the University of Galway. This is a partnership that we started, I think, in 2018. And for me, as a zoologist, specialist of venomous animals, of course, it opens opportunities to work with animals that we do not have, unfortunately for me and luckily for most Irish people over here on this island.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I'm essentially asking is, why did you go to University of Galway to study venomous animals? I mean, the most venomous animal thing you can get is a daddy long legs in Ireland, isn't that right?
Well, yes, in Ireland, I think that once we pass simply the stage of wasp or jellyfish, there is not much left in terms of venomous animals. So, no, it may seem actually somewhat unlikely, but... for me, it's a specialty that I have for over two decades now. And I ended up at the University of Galway, where I did my PhD on the venom system of centipedes, actually. And then I just continued working on this particular topic because those organisms are fascinating and they are very, very important, ecologically speaking, and of course, medically speaking as well, everywhere around the world. So... It's just something that is really relevant on a global stage.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about your project, because you were looking at species in Morocco. How many species are there? And what is the point of this research? What are you hoping to find out?
So in Morocco, we think that there is about 60 different species of scorpions. But even this is still debated because we haven't found them all yet and there are still species to be described out there. In the country as such, there is about 25,000 stings that are reported every year. Now, the true figure might actually be much higher than that. It's just that people actually do not report them to the authorities. And out of those 25,000 stings, there is anywhere between 50 and 100 deaths that occur annually.
Right. Okay. So these deaths presumably are from specific species of scorpions. Is it known what species of scorpions are deadly in Morocco, or is that part of this project?
So we have a pretty good idea of which species are really involved. There is a particular group of scorpions that live throughout North Africa and part of the Middle East that have the scientific name of Androctonus. And Androctonus in ancient Greek would actually mean man killer. So everything's in the name. This group of species is actually very, very dangerous to human beings. But because scorpions tend to really look alike, in Morocco, usually people just refer to yellow scorpions or black scorpions. It is actually possible that some other species of, for example, black scorpions are involved in deadly encounters. It's just that they have never been really considered for this. So we have strong doubts that actually there is another type of scorpions that may be involved too.
So, how did you go about doing this research? Presumably you had to go around, picking up scorpions that could be deadly.
Yes, it's pretty much that. So the way it all started is that every year, as part of our bachelor here in zoology, we actually bring our students to Morocco for a week so they can actually learn about the local environment. And pretty quickly, we actually realized that in the local communities, scorpion stings were really, really a problem. So we started to look a little bit into the diversity, so how many different type of species are present, and also the density of scorpions. And we then quickly saw that there were major, major hotspots for scorpion stings, that in fact those scorpion stings were not distributed equally everywhere throughout the country. And that, of course, triggered our interest. And we started to wonder if actually, the same species were always involved. So we started to collect scorpions. We started to actually check which species live where in central Morocco, where most of the stings occur. And we actually recorded over 450 different scorpions, so this way. And we also took different kind of environmental variables. We checked at, we looked at the temperature, we looked at the rainfall, we looked at the soil type and so on to really know where they were looking. And then we complemented that with a data set that we managed to get from iNaturalist, which is a fantastic online platform where members of the public can actually post pictures and coordinates of where they spotted animals. And then we used a particular machine learning algorithm to try and see if those scorpions were actually distributed specifically according to a particular set of environmental variables. Mm. So essentially, if the distribution of scorpions, and particularly the most dangerous ones, is controlled by, for example, temperature, humidity, rainfall, or soil type, or minimum temperature in the year, and so on.
And you found that it was, that you actually can almost predict where scorpions are likely to be based on soil type. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this is something that we were not really expecting. Of course, most people in this situation would actually think that scorpions are particularly attracted by areas that are warm, that are dry, where there might be a lot of stones or rubbles in order to hide. But we were not expecting that soil type specifically would be the main contributor to the distribution of scorpions. So it seems that scorpions are actually very picky and specific about the soil types they live on.
Why would that be? Are there any, I mean, obviously it's something you probably haven't got a final answer to yet, but any ideas?
So it seems that each species has its own little habitat, its own little ecological niche in this sense. But some of those most dangerous scorpions have a liking for rocky terrains where they can actually still dig a hide, but particularly under stones. And that means that we need to have the conjunction of a soft soil with also large boulders or large stones on top. And one of the issues is that, of course, soft soil with rubbles or stones on top of that tends to be agricultural land or land that has been modified for construction, for example, mining industry, for human activities, essentially.
Right. And so human presence is likely and so therefore an attack is likely as well. You talked about the ecology of scorpions. Talk to me a little bit about how they exist in their environment and how they affect other plants and animals, because I kind of think of scorpions as this, you know, this completely isolated animal that just lives apart from everything else, but that obviously can't be the case.
Oh no, scorpions are actually an integral part of their ecosystem. So first of all, they're very beneficial in the sense that they are predators and they feed on what we often consider pests. They will feed on crickets, on cockroaches, on grasshoppers, on caterpillars. So essentially animals that can be agricultural or household pests. Hmm. And that, of course, is very important and positive in a sense. Then second, some animals feed almost specifically on scorpions. There is, for example, a particular bird that is extremely rare anywhere in the world and is present in Morocco, the bald ibis, that feeds almost uniquely on scorpions.
Wow.
So we have an animal here that is really at the heart of a particular food chain, feeding on a group of animals and also being food for other organisms.
Wow, that's very surprising to me. So when it comes to the potency of a sting or the lethality of a scorpion, can that be predicted by soil type?
Yes, and this is something that is essential and fundamental to our work. So essentially, every single species of scorpion will have a different kind of venom. So that means that this potency of venom will vary from species to species, and sometimes even between males and females within the same species or between population of the same species in two different localities.
Both males and females sting?
Yes. So okay. Both males and females sting. And we're not too sure actually which one really would be most potent or which one is more likely to deliver venom, at least in larger quantities. But what is clear is that those variations are occurring. So it's extremely important to know what species of scorpion lives where and what type of venom it has. So appropriate treatments, medications, ICU beds, ventilators, and so on are available locally for those who get stung. There is no point to actually spread those resources everywhere in the country if in fact they are required and really needed only in 2, 3, or 4 hotspots over the whole country. So it's very important to have a good idea of what scorpions are present and what their venom is made out of. So now that we know which scorpions are present where, the next step of our work is actually to look at the venom profile of all the dangerous species and actually see how they vary in intensity, in composition, and then in their effects as well.
Obviously, behavior of a species has a huge impact on whether or not it's dangerous. You might be the most dangerous scorpion in the world, but if you're a very skittish animal that doesn't like conflict, then you're not a harm to anyone for the most part. In terms of the more venomous, more dangerous, more lethal scorpions, are they also the more aggressive and bold, or is there any correlation between lethality and behavior?
So they can be actually a correlation, but what happens is that those scorpions that are very dangerous, so as I've mentioned previously, tend to actually live in close proximity to human beings as well. They kind of enjoy that artificial environment created by human beings.
But is that not why we call them dangerous? Because they happen to be the scorpions that are closest to human beings, or are those two separate things?
To one extent, yes. The thing is, they basically have at the same time this faculty, this ability to live in close proximity to human beings and a very potent venom. There are some other species that live in agricultural land and so on that tend to be shy and spend their time anyway in their little hide. And those scorpions tend to have a very weak venom. So nobody really cares about them. You get stung by one, it's the equivalent of a bee sting, it's not fun, but you're not going to end up in hospital because of that. The dangerous one, those that we call dangerous, tend to be very active. They tend to move in and out of houses very easily as well. They're active hunters. They do not stay in their little hide waiting for a prey to approach. And their venom tend to be extremely potent because over the course of their evolution, they had two pathways in order to defend themselves. Either develop very big pinchers and use those pinchers as a primary mean of defense, or rely more heavily on their venom, keep small pinchers that are not particularly strong, but then sting a lot more readily when they face a potential danger.
God, it's fascinating, isn't it? Well, can you show us some of your live scorpions?
So here, for example, a giant Asian forest scorpion. So those guys are very, very large. They do have very big pinchers as well. So essentially, this species, not particularly dangerous. If I were to be stung by this guy, and actually I have been, not this specimen, but that same species.
It would make great TV, I've got to be honest with you.
Oh, I'm sure it would. So yeah, if I get stung by this guy, what would happen is that I'd develop some swelling. It would burn like a red hot charcoal on my skin for about an hour and a half or so. It's not fun, but definitely not a deadly one. Now I'm going to show you a deadly scorpion. Not a live one, because I need to be able to go back to my kids tonight. But up, you're going to see the difference in size and morphology. How much smaller this is.
Yeah.
As well, how thin the pinchers are in comparison to the other one.
Yeah.
So This is a species from Morocco. It's actually the species that is responsible for most death, we think. And this guy so has absolutely tiny little pinchers and has evolved over the course of millions of years to develop an incredibly potent venom that is neurotoxic. So it will essentially make your heart just beat incredibly fast, then terribly slow, then incredibly fast again, which is obviously not good for your organs, not good for your brain, not good for your heart. And after a while, what may happen is that your lungs will fill up with liquid as well. You will have a pulmonary edema. You will actually drown in your own liquid and mucus. And this is how most people die from scorpion stings. And I let you just see the absolutely tiny sting that it has. So those guys produce an incredibly small amount of venom, but that is incredibly potent.
Wow. I need to talk to you about following you in Morocco. That sounds like an amazing experience. So I'm going to give you a call, Dr. Michel Dugon. But for now, thank you so much for joining us. That's Assistant Professor in Zoology and PI at the Venom Systems Lab at the University of Galway, Dr. Michel Dugon. Thanks, Michel.
Thank you.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we had a really interesting episode where we were speaking with Adrian Wolfson, who was talking about how with AI, we could design literally creatures that have never existed before, not edit genes, but actually synthesize entirely new beings based on the likelihood of them working out and I suppose, existing. And so you'd use AI, it would look at proteins and amino acids and genetic material and sort of come up with a structure that would likely to be a living thing. And we're nearly at that phase yet. James says, I just don't think it's possible to apply global limits on applying artificial biological intelligence. How is that remotely enforceable? Because Adrian was suggesting that, you know, we need to put limits on the sort of research that we do and we have to be very careful about it. I mean, James, the thing is, you have these global agreements between countries, and for the most part, you know, they are adhered to. It obviously becomes much more public and much quicker when someone breaks the rules. But I think there is a general understanding that some research is just a very bad idea. And in countries, you know, scientists keep an eye on this area that they're working in. You know, so if you're working in mirror life, for example, you probably know most of the researchers who are doing, you know, interesting things in that area. And so it sounds like very difficult to monitor, but not everyone's going to really push the needle forward when it comes to research. And those who do are being watched very closely by their colleagues because, number one, they're mostly interested in the work that they do. That's my understanding of it. If you have a different understanding of it and you have more experience of working in a very restricted scientific area, I'd love to hear more detail on how that is policed. Could it, you know, on the face of it, you know, you are trusting other people not to advance dangerous technology. Joanne says, are there ecological risks of introducing extinct species into current ecosystems? Yes, there are, of course, because a lot of the ecosystems that we try and return extinct species to have moved on. And so the idea of, you know, bringing back the woolly mammoth is kind of a crazy one, in my opinion. And for most naturalists and people who, you know, who believe in, you know, protecting our species and conservation and so on, you know, you can't bring an extinct species back to an environment if you don't expect it to thrive. And the further away that extinct species gets from the current point in time, I think the more of a risk it is that it'll just fail because life has moved on. We also had an email from Aiden. He says, my 24-year-old daughter hates AI so much she uninstalled it from her new laptop, doing her master's and refuses to use AI. Her main reason for hating is the environment, but also loads of people will lose their jobs. I pointed out that I remember when computers were evil because they were going to take all the jobs. But the environment argument, is there any getting away from that? So that's an interesting one, Aiden. I do a lot of, you know, talking about AI. I do a lot of work in the area. Artificial intelligence is kind of like electricity or the internet or, you know, heat. It's everywhere and there's no avoiding it. Even if, unless you go completely off grid, and I mean like, you know, just, you know, water and food that you get from bushes and the sky. Like, that sort of level of off-grid is how far off-grid you would need to get before you would not have AI impact your decision-making, your choices, what it is that you did with your life. And so AI is around and has been around for a very long time. This new generation of generative AI is very dangerous in some respects, certainly for the environment. There seems to be no discussion about how to rein in the environmental impact of AI in America. It's just not on the table at all. And then, of course, there is the question about getting rid of jobs. I do think we're not quite ready for the rapid pace of change we're going to see. And I'm seeing it myself in my work. It's just moving so quickly. And I think smaller businesses probably haven't realized how quick people are iterating with it. And I do think there is a danger to jobs. So I think she's probably right, Aidan. I have no idea what the future looks like, though. Well, your comments on that, if you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Hugo da Silva, Scott on sound, and Rory Galvin, who was researching. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.